The next case is 98-2287, City of Ohio XRL East, Cooper Shack versus Industrial Commission of Ohio.
Even a jury, that says shall recommend. That's how they do it. And it's subjective, just like it is for us. Every time you recommend, you go to that point, and you say, it is because I say it is. He says, I might have it that we want, but that's the way it is. But if you find that he says shall, both the jury and the judge.
Mr. Jaffe.
Guarantee that we make the ruling you want, you're going to be a state creditor. place is trying to avoid that scenario where money goes, what should have gone to the tenant, goes to the state.
I can't agree with you. I can't agree with you that the legislature was trying to avoid money being paid to creditors. There is a provision in our revised code that says a creditor may not get F money, which has not been paid. Once the money is paid, a creditor may get F. What you've got here is a really peculiar situation, because as I say, I think what the legislature did first was to set this up so that accrued money could go to the defendant, and therefore, one, you avoid a probate problem.
When the money goes to the defendant, it doesn't flow to the estate, correct? If someone's found a defendant, it would go directly to the defendant,
right.
Not subject to a
right.
Attachment by creditors.
Up until the point it gets to the defendant.
Right. And then what?
At the point it gets to the defendant, if there's a creditor who has some kind of claimant on it somehow, that creditor may come forward.
But on the defendant, not on the
could be. Well, could be a joint thing. In other words, it could be that the defendant signed a piece of paper obligating the defendant as well as who it is that is the deceased. And so they both signed a piece of paper and they're both obligated. And once the money's paid to the defendant, the creditor is going to be paid. Let me say to you, I don't think this should be a creditor question. I think this should be a question of, does the estate stand in the shoes of the deceased? Because if the estate stands in the shoes of the deceased, and you so held back, I think, in 1922 in a case called Hopper, if in fact that estate is in the shoes of the deceased, and there is money that has not been paid to the deceased, and there is no dependent to whom the money can be paid, then the money ought to be paid to the estate. Otherwise, you do two things. One, you create a windfall for the fund or the self-insured, because this is money that clearly should have gone to the deceased. Secondly, you encourage delay, because delay may lead to death. And if delay leads to death, as you have said, then where are we?
The concept behind workers' compensation, of course, as you suggest, the policy is humanitarian, but it is a statutory scheme. In other words, it's not based on common law. It is limited by what the General Assembly decides that scheme should include. And I'm wondering if the argument you pose about the money should have gone to him and otherwise it's a windfall, I mean, is that the only way to look at it in view of the fact that the fund is set up by the General Assembly to benefit all citizens of the state and the humanitarian idea is for the money to go to claimants? Because we have to use the statutory language, claimants and dependents. It doesn't say heirs. Do we have to live by that language? And if it stays in the fund, that's for the benefit of everyone, not because it harmed these folks. If you're not dependent, you're not on the humanitarian goal.
I don't know that it benefits the fund.
Well, you aren't privileged to deplete the fund except when it's statutorily authorized.
The money is over. Had this man lived, he would have had the money.
But we only wanted to pay him if he had lived or if he had somebody depending on him for wages. That maybe is the policy.
I think you also have a law in the state called the probate law. I think it is understood money that is owed to somebody and somebody finds.
But it isn't a debt. Perhaps it might not, perhaps you're thinking of it in terms of a debt. And perhaps this is set up in a different way.
Isn't it analogous to that? Larson,
I think not.
Larson, in his treats this as just a matter of course. And he says unpaid installments, of course.
Go to dependents.
Go to the estate. Okay? Go to the estate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what you've got here, I think, this is the way I see it. The legislature created something first before it could go to the estate. And the first thing that is on point 60 is dependents. And the legislature had no reason to spell out anything more to say, gee, if there's no dependents, then in fact it goes to the estate. Because everybody understands if there is money owed, the estate has a claim. And that's what Larson says. And we quoted Larson in manual. You have now decided five cases in which you have clearly said that the estate of the dependent may obtain the accrued unpaid. And those cases covered a span going back, I think, to somewhere in the 1920s. You had the Dell case, you had the Hooker case, you had the Pardue case, you had the Whitmer case, and more recently, you had the Nosso case, which was decided mid-year last year. I ask, what is the difference? Why should the estate of the dependent be able to come after the accrued money, but the estate of the deceased worker may not come after it?
Doesn't that take an extension of Nosso? Isn't that what you're arguing? It's maybe a logical extension, but it's an extension of Nosso. One was the dependent, one was the estate, right?
Yeah, I would say that.
Okay. I'd like to straighten out the procedural matter, because that Court of Appeals opinion I struggled with and am still struggling with it. You have both a 59 and a 60 issue here. I'd like to start with 60, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
The question becomes, is it a 512, an appeal for right to participate, or extent of disability? Pretty clearly, and that's why when we wrote the Afrades opinion, I spent so much time going through all of those things. Do you agree that a 60 claim is an extent of disability, not a right to participate, and therefore should be handled mandamus?
Right. This is not a right to participate case.
Okay.
Participation has already been decided.
Right. Okay. But the Court of Appeals said it was. I think. Do you know? I mean, can you tell? In any event, if they said it, your contention would be they'd have to be reversed on the right to participate versus extent of disability on a 60. And what we should hold is, if we were consistent with all those other cases, is that a 60 claim is extent of disability.
If you want to phrase it that way, you can phrase it the other way, too. The legislature, the very last sentence in 460, says it's not appealable.
Yeah, and you started it by way of mandamus.
No, we started this thing by filing an appeal from the original order denying everything. And after we had filed that appeal, which was a 512 appeal, the Attorney General turned around and filed a motion to dismiss the entire case because of his extended disability. When the Attorney General did that in October of 98, we then turned around. And file
when I said you started, that's what I mean. The case we have before us is your mandamus case.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. Okay, now that's 60. Well, but we have to straighten this out, because the 59 now, would it be fair to say that the extension of Nosso, that if that's what it is that you're asking for, that the amount that is accrued up until the death of the claimant is the amount that should be payable to the estate, not anything beyond that, unless the other people are dependents?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jaffe. Mr. Gold.
Hey, please, Lord. My name is Frank Goldheimer. In this case, we have two distinct issues. And the first is whether the appellant, Peter Filipczak, has an adequate remedy law that prevents her from filing mandamus action. The second issue is whether the estate of Robert Filipczak is entitled to the compensation under Advisement 4123.60. I'll touch on the first issue briefly. It is a contention of the appellee that Peter Filipczak must prove that she is independent either under Revised Code 4123.59 or Revised Code 4123.60 prior to filing a mandamus action. That is a basic right to state issue. She has to determine, she has to prove in a trial court that she was dependent on this claim.
She gets it automatically or doesn't based on her dependency. The determination, is it not, of the right to participate is that of the claimant.
That's exactly true, Your Honor.
And it was determined that the claimant had a right to participate. Therefore, anything after that is extent of disability, is it not?
That is incorrect, because Edith Filipczak is a claimant in her own right. She has to prove that she has the right to participate. Under 59 and 60, she has to prove that she is a dependent.
But only derivatively. She's only a claimant derivatively.
No, she's a claimant of her own right.
Yeah, derivatively, through his, she can't be a claimant to something that was never adjudicated, that he had a right to participate.
That is correct.
Okay.
She also has to show that she has the right to participate. If she can't hit that threshold dependency issue of whether she's dependent upon him, she can't get to the extent of disability.
And what's the nature of the action?
It's a 512 action.
But you can do that in a mandamus action, too. You could defend in a mandamus action that she is not a dependent.
Conceivably, but the fact is, she has to prove that right to participate because the commission made a determination which terminated her right to participate in the fund and said, you are not a dependent, you are not entitled to this compensation. As such, based on 5.41.3.512, and this is, of course, many holdings in this area, Frey's, Belly's, and so on, her right to participate was not. And specifically, this court in Reeves versus Flowers, which is cited in the magistrate's decision, and that case is dealing with surviving parents who were attempting to allege they were wholly dependent upon their son. And this court said, because they were determined to be partially dependent, that this was not an appeal that could be filed with the
This is, to me, unusual for the argument you're making to suggest that a dependent is seeking a right to participate. You know, I agree that with Justice Douglas that her receiving any funds from the fund would be by virtue of the claimant having qualified as right to participate because his injury, disease, or death occurred in the course of or and arising out of his employment.
Well, her right to
because first he must be there must be an adjudication that he or she, the claimant, has a right to participate because having been injured in the course and arising out of employment or death in this case. Right. Okay. I just you don't need to repeat it. I'm thinking it's very unusual.
It's an
unusual argument. Why is this rare?
Because she's not dependent upon.
Well, she's not. It's only rare. That doesn't make it rare. She's either dependent or not. That's common that someone says, I'm dependent, and we have standards by which that's judged, dependency.
What I meant was, in this case, it's determined she was not dependent at all.
Right.
In most circumstances, there is at least a partial dependence.
Mm.
In this case, there was no dependency whatsoever.
You know, the problem I'm having with this is why your side would even fight this. I mean, why your side would even fight this, because all you're going to do is open up that whole question of, again, right to participate versus extent of disability. And I can think of all sorts of orders. In fact, there's another very obscure section of the statute that gives you the right to appeal. I just looked at it the other day on what are interlocutory orders of the commission, and you're going to be right in the position where all of these things are going to go back before a trial court, and then we're going to end up saying, look, we've told you it's either right to participate, and if it isn't, it's extended disability. Why wouldn't you just defend it mandamus, say she's not a dependent, show that she's not a dependent, and she loses?
Well, we defended it in both actions, Your Honor, as you're well aware.
Yeah.
In the 512 case, the trial court allowed her to proceed. And as such, we conducted discovery. We showed through the evidence of the depositions against the interrogatory, so on and so forth, that she was not dependent.
But when you moved to dismiss on the fact that the original action that they filed, the original appeal, why would you not have joined with them then and said, yes, particularly given the language of 60 that says you have no right to appeal, why would you not have joined with them and said, yep, this is an extended disability and it ought to be determined under mandamus?
First of all, the language says it's not appealable pursuant to an administrator's order, which is the Administrative Bureau of Workers' Compensation. It's not appealable under 502. What that says is, if the administrator issues an order, it first must go to the industrial commission under revised code 4123.511. As we all know, this is a right to participate instead of disability issue. It's a very difficult issue. And when the initial motion to dismiss was filed, I believe now, and I was the attorney of record on that, I believe now that was an error. I believe this is a right to participate issue. While I admit it was error, the trial court did the correct thing and allowed them to proceed and prosecute their case. They prosecuted it to the fullest extent. Determined she was not dependent upon the claim of Robert Lewis.
So now the Court of Appeals is wrong.
No, they're not. Which Court of Appeals, Your Honor? The 10th District was correct.
It was the 7th District that was involved too, wasn't it? Earlier?
Yes, there was 7th District also that issued their decision on March 23rd, 2000. And they said that the 59 issue was a right to participate issue. And that is currently on appeal. Front of this court on discretionary appeal. It's the position of the commission that this is a right to participate issue. She had the right to litigate this. She did litigate it. She was not denied any day, her day in court case. And as such, we would ask that you affirm the 10th District Court of Appeals decision. The second issue I want to discuss is whether the state of Robert Lewosha is entitled to approved compensation. And I believe this court has been consistent throughout the years. With Ward, Dell, and Hofer, this court said that a state is entitled to compensation. However, in other cases, State X Rel Rowland, State X Rel Bizzell, this court said that the claimant is not entitled to compensation. And I believe Justice Stratton pointed out that creditors would truly attack this money. Who is the commission to award this money to? Could they award it to the estate first without regard to dependency? And then the dependents would not take under it? And this court made a crucial point in saying it's all rolling.
Here there was a request by mother claimed to be independent. She lost.
Yes. As of this point in time.
But now, you're saying not only should she lose, but the estate should not get the money either?
Based on this court's precedence, yes, Your Honor.
And what purpose does that serve?
The purpose serves, as Justice Cook pointed out, the Constitution, not only is the statutory authority, it's constitutional. The Constitution says that law shall be enacted to award compensation to workmen and their dependents. In this case, the worker is deceased.
Okay, but wasn't that once that compensation was, isn't that vested at some point? And isn't there a counter to good public policy? They own the argument that the state shouldn't get it either. Would that encourage the system or some evil person over there who looks at these folks and say, yeah, we got all these people who are going to die if we just drag out the litigation or sit on the check, we won't have to pay anyway.
No, Your Honor. Actually, in this case, once the application was filed on behalf of the alleged and also the estate, it was 4 or 5 months and it was out of the system. The commission had issued their last decision. Their last decision came, and I believe it was September of 1996.
But they were resisting recognizing this claim all along while this guy's dying, right?
When the commission issued the decision, they based it on the legislative authority. And as Justice Cook mentioned, this is a creature of statute. Workers' compensation system is a creature of statute. What authority did the commission have to award this compensation to a mother who's not dependent or based on this court's decision, the commission had no authority to grant that compensation to an estate. It simply is not there. Revised Code 41.3.60 specifically dictates that only spouses and dependents are entitled.
I guess you're not following what I'm saying. It's just the commission, or somebody, or they're dug in and they weren't going to recognize this guy's claim, period. Right? Initially? Did it come here, all the way here?
Yes, and when this court issued its decision.
So, if you end up where you want to go, doesn't that at least put in place something that structurally encourages, not to say that anybody there right now would take that attitude, but there's a financial incentive to look at really sick people, say, let's say we don't owe anything, let's fight this. And by the time it's determined that we do owe something, they'll be gone.
I would respectfully disagree with Your Honor. When this court issued its decision in the first of the Bochek case, that overturned the previous case law. You said, since this disease is a long...
Maybe this isn't the great case for that, but I'm saying what you want us to hold, that nobody gets the money, could encourage that, even where it's pretty clear cut that people are entitled.
I don't believe it would encourage that, Your Honor, because the commission, when it issued its decision, based its decision on the law. Imagine, for sake of argument, that we had an employer that was acting in this case. They would have thought that they was actually separated for appeals. The commission has no authority to grant this compensation to an estate. Where does the statute say? Where does the Constitution say? The commission simply had no authority. And this court's decision specifically states that the dependent estate can receive the compensation. In this case, we don't have it. We only have to be claiming this position. And the dependent estate, since 1932, has not been entitled to receive the compensation. The commission is simply following the laws as this court has decided. And since they have decided that it claims the state for various reasons, one is the creditor's issue. The award to the creditors not
over. You might not understand the creditor. The creditor's issue only is that law was set up so that dependents who say creditors, but let me go directly to dependents, not in the state, so creditors can't get the hand. But they're right. But if there aren't dependents in the term of they're actually getting financial benefit, person at that time.
This is a unique case, Your Honor. Many cases, there are dependents, and what happens at that point in time, if there are dependents, and this court comes down with a decision that says the states are entitled to receive the compensation, we're going to have the estate on one hand, granted in this case, they're on the same side, but we have competing interests that say, wait,
does the word dependent have a different meaning when you're talking about children? For example, or do you have proof, again, that they are actually dependent, not just children?
Minor
children.
I think it's pretty much presumed that children are children.
Yeah, but there are a lot of minor children that don't get a nickel from there.
That is true.
And so is the commission going to step in every time there? I mean, they might not be getting a nickel because it's a deadbeat dad. Facts and fly up there, would you have the same result? Okay.
No,
because the kids weren't getting it.
Well, obviously, at that point, the commission would look at the facts and the statute speaks to that. They look at the circumstances of that case, and if he is a deadbeat dad, they would still find that the child was dependent upon the father, but for the father's actions.
Well, a 90-year-old mother could also be dependent from that standpoint. If the son had any ability to help, should be.
I think there's a distinction between a father and child as compared to a father and his mother. tourist until we're 18 years old.
There's a legal duty to do that, statutory.
Statutory, thank you, Your Honor. But I think in many cases, I don't support my parents, but the point is, there's a big distinction between children and mothers. I see that my time is up. I would just ask that this court confirm the 10th District Court of Appeals decision.
Thank you, Mr. Gold. Mr. Jaffe, you saved a little over 3 minutes of your time.
The Court of Appeals relies heavily on the Ross case. Is the Ross case even...
No, Ross case did not apply. It indicated in the research Ross was irrelevant.
And they relied on that, the Court of Appeals.
The other thing that's interesting is they relied on two Court of Appeals cases, one called Mayo and the other called Bradford. Mayo was not this kind of case. Mayo was a case where the estate of the deceased came into court directly rather than the dependent filing under 0.60. And in Mayo, the Court of Appeals said you've got a remedy. And this is not appropriate. File under 60. That was Mayo. Bradford is an abatement case. One of the peculiar things here is there were a number of cases that were abatement cases. Abatement cases essentially mean person has died, claim abates. But I think you're past that stage. You overruled Breitbart. The peculiar thing here, and as I said, the thing I didn't hear an answer to is, why is it different? Why can we permit the administrator of the dependent's estate to come forward and claim the unpaid benefits? Because there's nothing in the statute says anything about the dependent's estate, but we won't permit the administrator of the DC, that's the injured worker, we won't permit that administrator to ask for the unpaid benefits.
If we might.
This is a phony argument. The way this is set up and what the legislature has done is to say before the estate can do anything, we're going to consider the dependents. And if we've got a dependent, fine, it's going to go to the dependent, and the estate doesn't have a claim. But on the other hand, in those cases where there is no dependent, what happens with the money? The money goes to the estate.
You say that though the statute doesn't say that, I mean, your suggestion is the court just kind of consider that as implied by the General Assembly?
I think the syllabus as I would write it would start out something like where a claim is made for accrued but unpaid monies. And the application under point 60 shows that there is no dependent. Then the estate may proceed to obtain the accrued unpaid monies.
And the authority for that, given that this is statutory, the authority for the court to take that position?
My authority on it, very frankly, is two things. One, I think the estate has a claim for unpaid money, and I don't think the legislature has to spell it out, and you've already done
okay,
it.
Okay, so you are saying...
You've already done it for the dependent.
Absolutely. Okay. But you're still, nevertheless, we're still saying it's, we're going to write it into the statute.
I don't think you're writing it in at all. I think it's a
point.
Let me go back a second with you, but the point hasn't been made. There is, as best I can tell, there is only one case that ever said that the estate of the decedent couldn't make a claim. That case was a case called Rowland. And Rowland relied on a case called Bozella for its authority. Bozella was an abatement case. In Bozella, there was dicta an estate. But in Rowland is the only case. In Rowland, they treated the estate as a creditor, not recognizing that the estate, under probate law, has a claim of its own. And so what I'm suggesting to you is very simple. I'm saying, look, the legislature wanted to avoid the expense of estates, wanted to make this thing work quickly. They provided point 60 so that the money could go to dependents. Fine, no problem. They didn't think it necessary to continue to spell out that if in fact there are no dependents, the estate has a claim.
But that's
my position. That's
where we have to write something into the statute.
I don't think you're writing anything into it.
Well, there's no authority in the statute for doing what you suggest. Probate.
Sure. I think probate law applies when you get to this stage. Mm-hmm. And what I'm saying to you is, rather than going through probate court, finding some, trying to get money, this is permitted in terms of what we have here.
Well, Jaffe, I think you put it at your brief. I'd like to hear your response. If we adopt that argument that you're making, what do we do with 4129-2359A, says that there are no dependents, that's this case, no dependents, the disbursement from the state insurance fund is limited to the expenses provided for in section 0.66, which is funeral expenses and so forth. What do we do with that language?
We have a separate provision in 0.69. It is dealing with death benefits. It is dealing with a widow or a spouse. It is dealing with monies that would be paid to them. And it is making clear that if there's no monies paid to them, then in fact, the only thing can be paid is medical expenses of the deceased. But 0.60 is a totally different matter. 0.60 says, gee, this money is owed. We're past the stage of having to determine should the money be paid or not. We have made a determination to pay the money. And in fact, what happens? That's what 0.60 is dealing with. This is owed money.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised for our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.